counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. Anne Marie Phillips, court-appointed amicus counsel, arguing on behalf of Dr. Syed Rafi. On January 23, 1998, after 5 years of relentless pursuit and over 24 applications to National Institutes of Health, an agency that had just created the world's largest human genome research institute, Dr. Rafi, a well-qualified and experienced cytogeneticist, was definitively told there was not a single paid or unpaid position available to him at that institute. January 23, 1998, believing he was the victim of discrimination by the institutes, Dr. Rafi timely pursued his claim before the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and ultimately brought suit to the District of Columbia.
Ms. Phillips, can I ask you, your claim is, and it's what you just said and what was in the complaint, that it's this January 23rd letter.
Correct.
That alerted him that he was being discriminated against. Is that right?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right. So the district court said that there was no material difference between the January 23rd letter and the July 21, 1997, that is the January 23rd, 1998 letter and the July 21, 1997 letter. And I have to say, at first reading, they look pretty much the same. So what's wrong with the district court's argument?
I agree with you. At first reading, it does look the same.
Well, this is about my 10th reading, but I'm sure you can find something.
On my 100th reading.
Yes.
I have found. Yes, Your Honors. You're very right, Judge Garland. When we look at the January 23rd, 1998 letter, JA-80, you'll see that there's very specific wording here that would alert anybody at this point that something is going on that is not quite right. Dr. Rafi had corresponded with Dr. Trent for a volunteer position in one of his many laboratories at the National Institutes of Health. This letter actually responds saying there is no laboratory space available, nor positions, paid or unpaid, volunteer or paid, in parenthetical, available to you at this time. This letter, unlike the previous letters, made conclusive and definitive statements that there was not a single position available at the National Institutes of Health.
This one says, at the present time, and the previous one said, at the present time, we do not have an opening that would match your interests.
The 1997 letter was responding to a single inquiry for a position and responded back that that position was not available. The 1998 letter was also in response to a single inquiry for employment, yet it says there are no positions, absolutely none whatsoever.
That's what the July letter says, too. It says we do not have an opening that would match your interests.
But the January 1998 letter says that there are no positions, either paid or unpaid.
I agree with you, it adds either volunteer or paid, but that's... The original one said, we do not have an opening that would match your interests. That seems pretty definitive to me.
To Dr. Rafi, that correspondence was positive and encouraging, that should something come up in the future, he would be considered for that position.
Let me just check. You agree that the test is not subjective, right? It's either know or reasonably should know, something like that. I can't remember exactly what the language is, right? That's an objective test, right? It's not... We can't figure out what Dr. Rafi thought. We have to look at the reasonableness question for purposes of exhaustion. That's all I'm talking about.
Correct.
And you agree with that then?
I do.
All right. So then we don't ask what it means to Dr. Rafi. We ask what it means objectively.
To a reasonable person, right. The 1997 letter was a rejection to a specific position that he was requesting, and it said the position was not available. The 1998 letter is more broad and says there are absolutely no positions, volunteer or paid, available to you. That language was definitive to Dr. Rafi that there was not a single position he could acquire at the National Institutes of Health, specifically the National Human Genome Research
Institute. If we agree that the 97 with the district court, that the 97 letters sufficiently definitive, then that's the end of the case, right? On those counts.
On those 10 counts that were dismissed, that's correct.
Okay.
But we argue that the 1997 letter does not definitively state that there were absolutely no positions available to him. And it wasn't until after numerous times of applying, over 24 different applications, that he finally received this letter, the most definitive letter of all, saying that there were no positions. So our argument is, while the 1997 letter may have caused some suspicion of discrimination, suspicion is not the standard for triggering a Title VII action. Rather, it is whether the individual knew or had reason to know that he was being discriminated against. And the district court, in dismissing the case on the 12B6, applied a reasonable suspicion standard.
What exactly is the difference between reasonable suspicion and reason to know?
Suspicion and knowledge are defined very clearly on polar spectrums of the understanding continuum.
Matter of degree.
Right. To know something is to know with certainty and have no doubt.
Webster's reason to know, though, yeah. If it said no, but it says no or reason to know.
What a reasonable person would know. But suspicion is still different. Suspicion is not knowing, having some doubt as to the untruth. So even if it's a reasonable person standard, it's still what would a reasonable person know, not suspect.
Does it matter what the test the district court applied, since we have to do this de novo anyway? He dismissed this as a matter of law, right?
He did.
So we have to do it de novo. We would, of course, apply the 29 CFR 1614.105, which you've asked us to do, and we can't defer to the district court's decision about this anyway. So long as we agree with you that the CFR is the CFR, we don't really have to reach the difference between suspicion and reason to know, do we?
No, but on the de novo review for a 12B6 dismissal, you do have to accept all the complaints and the allegation is true.
Right.
And Dr. Rafi alleged that he did not know or have reason to know.
No, we don't have to accept that.
We don't have to accept the conclusions expressed in the complaint.
Since he told us.
It's only the factual allegations that we have to accept as true.
Besides, he told us that in the complaint, and as you've told us, and it's in the briefs and everywhere, that the January 23rd, 1998 letter was enough, right?
Yes.
So the only remaining question is whether the July 21st letter is materially different from the January 23rd letter on that question.
And we argue that it is.
Right, I understand.
The language of the letter is. And it's enough to preserve his 10 claims told under 1614.105.
Okay.
There were two other errors reviewable made by the district court. The second error dealt with the district court's Rule 50 judgment as a matter of law, dismissing the two claims that Dr. Rafi did take to trial. In the discrimination case, it is rare, if not impossible, to get the smoking gun, the definitive memo, email, or illicit testimony that discrimination occurred. Rather, the trier of fact, the jury, has to weigh the evidence that's brought before the court, the credibility of the witnesses, and the weight of the documents.
All true, but an element of the plaintiff's case is that there be an opening, right? Even a volunteer, leave aside whether a volunteer is good enough or not, but assume for the moment that it's completely okay. There still has to be an opening, right?
Correct.
Okay. So what is the evidence that he put on that there was an opening? Bisecker testified that there were no positions available in his section. So what's the evidence that there was an opening?
Dr. Rafi testified that Dr. Trent was in charge of numerous laboratories at NIH.
Yeah.
And there were various volunteers throughout the National Human Genome Research.
He did not testify that there was an opening. He just testified that Dr. Trent had a lot of people working for him. That doesn't, the United States has a lot of people working for him. It doesn't mean that there's an opening at a particular time.
But volunteer positions were determined by the doctors who headed up the laboratories. So the doctor who headed up the laboratory could determine whether a position was available.
Well, is there evidence that Trent at any time could have hired any number of volunteers that he wanted? Was that put into evidence? I don't see anything like that.
There was no evidence to the contrary.
Well, but you have the obligation to prove that there is an opening. That's part of your burden.
But Dr. Rafi did put on at the trial court that there were other volunteers working in the laboratories in and around the time that Dr. Rafi was applying, and in fact, other volunteers who were hired or brought into the laboratory after he was rejected.
Other than Mr. Philip Pantonio, other than he, was there any evidence? That was the only one I thought that he argued had been hired.
Dr. Ning was also.
Who?
Dr. Ning.
And what was the evidence about Dr. Neem?
Dr. Neem worked in the area of cytogenetics, and he worked with Dr. Biesecker's laboratories on several issues dealing with cytogenetics.
And where, can you point me to the page in the record where there was testimony that there was an opening that Dr. Neem... How do you spell his name, Ming or Ning?
Well, in the transcript, it's spelled with an M, M-I-N-G, but his name is spelled Ning with an N, N-I-N-G. Dr. Ning's testimony is actually in Volume 2 of the transcript, which begins on...
I don't want to know where it begins, because it's a long transcript. Where's the page where he says, where he says there was an opening and he filled it?
Well, Dr. Ning actually didn't work as a volunteer. He worked as a volunteer in Dr. Ledbetter's laboratory. He was not working in Dr. Biesecker's laboratory. He was working with Dr. Biesecker, though, at the time that Dr. Rafi was applying.
Well, that suggests somebody's already filled the spot. Is there where? I also don't remember this in the brief. Is this in the brief, Ms. Ming?
I'd have to. We did discuss Dr. Ning in the brief.
Okay.
Yes.
So is there testimony that there was an opening after the time that Rafi applied and it was filled by Ming?
No, that wasn't the testimony. The testimony put on was that Drs. Biesecker and Drs. Trent could bring in volunteers when they needed them in the laboratory. Now, Dr. Biesecker did testify that he didn't need a volunteer at that time.
What was the evidence that he did need one?
Well, that he had worked with other volunteers already in the National Human Genome Institute, and that Dr. Rafi could have done anything in his laboratory at an unpaid position at any time.
Well, his testimony was, Biesecker's testimony was he didn't do the same kind of work that Dr. Rafi did, that he didn't do cytogenetics.
But that was actually contradicted by Dr. Ning, who said he did work with Dr. Biesecker on cytogenetic research. Moreover, Dr. Trent had numerous laboratories, some of which did work specifically in cytogenetic areas.
But there was no testimony that he had an opening.
There was testimony that Dr. Trent took on volunteers regularly in his laboratories.
Well, that's different.
That's different. I understand the point about volunteers, but if your position is that you can send in an application and always be able to bring a lawsuit because, well, we're only asking for volunteers, and whether they have openings for volunteers or not, they could hire volunteers, that's really stretching quite far. Unless you have evidence that every year he hires five volunteers or, you know, something. Just because the guy wants to work doesn't mean that there has to be an opening for him.
But that leads to the third issue that was reviewable, Your Honor.
Yeah.
And that issue is the discovery abuses that occurred at the district court. Dr. Rafi was repeatedly denied the discovery that he needed on personnel files, volunteer records, statistical analysis that would give him this kind of information.
Why didn't he call Trent? He could have called Trent at the trial. My question is the prejudice here. I'll skip for the moment the question of whether discovery should have been granted. He could have called Trent. Why didn't he call Trent to testify?
I don't know that, Your Honor.
Okay. So, but since he could have called Trent, in fact, Trent was listed as a government witness. They never got to that. Frankly, it sounds like what happened is he thought he wouldn't have to call Trent because the government would, and then he could cross him. Well, That's a gamble. That's a trial lawyer's gamble.
Right, and Dr.
Which he lost. But the trial lawyer lost.
Well, and the trial lawyer only had 2 months to prepare for trial in the time that he came onto the case. And he requested an extension of time from the district court to depose individuals, to issue document requests and interrogatories, to gather the evidence he needed, and the trial court denied him that opportunity. So even if you don't think that Dr. Rafi was able to put on a prima facie case at the actual trial, the Rule 50 should still be reversed because of the discovery abuses and the evidence that he was not able to obtain from the government in order to get to trial.
That's the question. What was the evidence? So we have even if the court erred, we have to consider whether it was prejudicial or not. So we have to know what the evidence would have been. And how do we know what the evidence would have been?
Well, Dr. Rafi requested personnel files, which he didn't receive. He requested NIH hiring policies, statistical reports on how many persons of Indian descent were actually hired. He asked for a lot of discovery and didn't get any of it. The court denied it all, assuming that he had received it when he got discovery on the very narrow issue of whether a volunteer could be an employee under Title VII. And the truth is he just didn't get the discovery he needed. So there are lots of documents he could go back to NIH to get. Unless there are further questions.
Any further questions? Your time actually is up, although if necessary, we'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the appellee.
May it please the court. I'd like to respond briefly to the questions raised by the court with regard to the evidence at trial regarding an opening at the laboratories. The testimony before the district court by Dr. Biesecker was, first of all, let me deal with the testimony by, is a she, Dr. Ning. And she, as the court is aware, as well as Dr. Filippano, were neither special volunteers. They were both IRTA fellows. And so they came to the...
This was not something that he was applying for.
Well, and he was not eligible to be one, Your Honor, because he was not within 5 years.
I saw the testimony about Filippano being a fellow. I didn't see the testimony about Ning. So that,
right.
He was not a volunteer.
And Dr. Ning was not a special.
She was not a.
No. So the testimony about Dr. Ning was that the cytogenetics was a very broad term. And as the court recalls, Dr. Filippano said that he had only done the cytogenetics work way before he came
to 1992 or something.
Yes, that period before he came to the NIH. So the evidence that was presented at trial with the witnesses called by Dr. Raffrey indicated that there were no openings, number one, that fit the skill level or the interests of Dr. Raffi. Dr. Biesecker's testimony was that Dr. Raffi's use of the microscope in terms of the cytogenetics was as consistent with the work that he did because he didn't use microscopes in his laboratory. Dr. Ning also confirmed that the work that Dr. Biesecker did involve molecular genetics. The testimony by Dr. Filippano was that once he arrived there, he was really not involved in the work of the cytogenetics. So, Your Honor, if you look at the witnesses presented by Dr. Raffrey with his own testimony, excluding his own testimony, you have Dr. Biesecker, Dr. Betty Graham, Dr. Filippano, Dr. Ning, neither of those witnesses corroborate any testimony. There was an opening at the time he sought to be a volunteer in 1998. In addition, Your Honor, I would like to respond to the argument regarding discovery. As the court is aware in this case, the attorney for Dr. Raffi, Ms. Stevenson, withdrew. And after the court's order for discovery, March 27th, that where he accepted her recusal from the case, he indicated at that time that his March 27th order was going to be modified. And he set a status in the case for June 3rd. So as of in the spring, as early as March and April, Dr. Raffi was fully aware that he needed to seek representation in this case. There was no discovery period ongoing at that time. And Dr. Raffi did not file any discovery until several months later.
Did the court ever set a deadline for when this pretrial discovery had to be completed? I guess one of the pretrial hearings there's no record of, or at least we don't have a record of it, so it's hard to tell.
Well, Your Honor,
was there a deadline ever set?
Well, no. What he said was, he said in the March order, he wanted the parties to submit a discovery plan. That did not occur because Ms. Stevenson withdrew from the case. But what the court did was to issue another order, I believe it's April 18th, in which the court says my March order is modified and Mr. Rafi is to seek representation. So there is no discovery period that the court put in place for the parties to engage in discovery. In October, Dr. Rafi files discovery, I believe it's about 32 days before the parties were to go to trial. And the district court, we believe, properly did not abuse his discretion in saying, first of all, he said that he was hesitant to allow discovery so close to trial on the objection of the government, but he did allow discovery. And so Dr. Rafi, with the assistance of counsel, at that point had the opportunity to conduct discovery. He was permitted to do so by the court.
Is this the one where he's only permitted to do interrogatories?
Well, he was permitted to do interrogatories, Your Honor, initially. He did not allow the production of documents.
The court is right that interrogatories rarely yield anything useful.
Well, that was the court's comment, Your Honor.
But that's probably right. So that to give him the right to do interrogatories isn't giving him very much.
Well, Your Honor, it was Mr. Branch's responsibility and obligation at that point to propound the discovery he thought appropriate. However, again, the discovery that was propounded related to the positions, the pay positions, which had those claims had already been dismissed by the court.
Those
claims.
That was the only discovery that was propounded was about the exhaustion claims?
Well, not only the exhaustion claims, but in addition to compensation, Your Honor.
But not counts one and two?
The discovery had already been conducted with regard to the compensation issues regarding volunteers.
Right, but not the question of whether there was an opening.
In terms of what was allowed or the questions?
Discovery allowed on the question. I appreciate maybe people weren't focusing at that point, and that didn't get focused on until in the middle of the trial, but was there an opportunity to have sought discovery about whether there were openings for the two positions at issue in counts one and two?
My recollection, Your Honor, is that the court did not preclude Dr. Rafi on a subject area. It was the obligation of the Dr. Rafi to present the discovery to the court that he sought. The court did not say you can't have discovery on this issue.
And are you saying that in the discovery that was propounded in the sort of broad interrogatories, there weren't questions about whether there were openings?
I don't recall a question about openings, Your Honor, with regard to the volunteer, as the court is phrasing it. But there were questions, my recollection is, about the compensation issue related to the volunteer issue. And the position that we took at that time was that we had already, in prior discovery, through the depositions and through the production of documents, already responded to that discovery.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing none. Yeah, counsel was out of time, but we'll give back 2 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. I won't take that much time. I'd just like to point out and correct that counsel for the government was a little mistaken on what the court ordered for discovery in his September 30th, 2005 order. The court specifically said, and you'll see it on JA-25, plaintiff will be permitted to take discovery on the connection between volunteer research positions and subsequent paid employee positions. Because an unfavorable resolution of this question would obviate the need to consider the defendant's motivation for rejecting the application, further discovery is precluded at this time. As such, Dr. Rafi never had full and fair discovery.
What about in the subsequent, when he was given permission to do interrogatories?
Well, the timing of the case was very difficult for Dr. Rafi, because once the issue of whether a volunteer could be an employee under Title VII was decided, his counsel left him. That was the crucial time to begin discovery. He didn't have counsel again for another 8 months. He tried to move the court to compel discovery, the court ignored his motion. When he did get counsel, counsel asked for a mere 60 days to get additional documents, additional deposition testimony, and he was limited to only a few narrow interrogatories. So Dr. Rafi just did not have the opportunity to explore these issues fairly. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you appear here as a volunteer amicus on in service to the court, and the court thanks you and your law firm for the provision.
I would also want to say this is you are excellent, and I hope we see you again. Ms. Johnson is always excellent, so we don't have to keep telling her. She's here a lot, but this was quite excellent as amicus.
No good deed goes unpunished.
Yeah, now we're going to ask you to come back.